Good evening. I'm Trish England, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Did you know all our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, also in the Internet Archive, archive.org, and on a number of podcast platforms. If you missed any of our previous shows, such as David Hobbs, Derek Bell, and John Fitzpatrick's Extravaganza, the Escort GTU Firehawk shows, or our Le Mans drivers and our introduction to the IMSA management and staff, they're all on our website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and on podcasts from iHeartRadio, Google, Amazon, and Spotify. Now we're reaching millions of fans. Oh, no. Download the apps and listen on your phone, your car radio, or on your computer. Yeah. Tonight, we present the first in a series of random episodes surrounding America's favorite race circuits. And for this evening, we have Road Atlanta, my beloved home track. A little background. In 1969, David Sloyer, Earl Walker, and Arthur Montgomery purchased 750 acres of farmland in Braselton, Georgia, with the intent to build a world-class road racing facility. Along came a Can-Am race that had meant to be on another track but was flooded out, so the series organizers chose Road Atlanta to replace it. So the track began to take form really quickly, taking only 6 months to excavate, grade, and pave the road course. During this time, I came over from the family lake house to putter around and observe the track under construction. Lots of red mud and kudzu. There was a big sign on Highway 53 that proclaimed Road Atlanta opening in 1970. That sign has been restored and is displayed now at Jim Downing's race shop 45 minutes south of the track. The first race was held on September 13, 1970. Dick Elford in a Chaparral 2J won the pole. Tony Dean in a Porsche 908-02 won the Can-Am event with Sterling Moss as the Grand Marshal. During the 70s and 80s, the track hosted Can-Am, Formula 5000, IMSA Camel GTs, and Trans Am, driven by everybody who was anybody. The crowds of spectators were great. The sponsorships were tremendous, but the ownership and management went through many changes. They caused the track to hit bottom financially in 1993. Then a consortium of owners brought it back to life, followed by the sale to Dan Panos in 96. He flooded the circuit with millions of dollars in improvements, including the infield paddock and the fan zone, and numerous track renovations. He then sold it to NASCAR Holdings in 2012, and even more money poured in, along with a new race series and several events. With the arrival of Michelin as the track's first entitlement sponsor in 2019, came the new five-story tower. It took me a while to get used to that, with its monstrous cartoon character on two sides. But I'll admit, it's beautiful at night. Okay, tonight's guest panel is large and is a collection of drivers, along with a former manager of the track and a racing school manager and professor. Each guest has personal memories of this beautiful circuit. They are Janet Upchurch, Terry Earwood, Dave Murray, John Norris, Rick Newt, Randy Pokes, and Bobby and Dylan Archer, and maybe others will sneak up on us. Thank you all for our panel members. It's a big group, so we need to get moving. So, to the audience, please mute your phones. If you have a question, send it via chat, and our producer will pass it along. Everybody ready? Okay.
Yep.
I'm going to throw this out. One thing I'm going to ask you is, if when you start to answer a question or to speak, how about identifying yourself? Because nobody knows each other by their voices. I certainly don't. So if you can do that for us, it will help things go a little more smoothly and make more sense. What was your first impression of your first event at Road Atlanta as a driver? What team were you with, and how did you do that time? Oh, don't rush into it, y'all.
Well, let Randy Pope start.
Okay.
I will.
Take it away.
I'm,
I'm Randy Popes. Hi, Trish and everybody else. My first time to Road Atlanta was in 1986. Very early in my road racing career, I started out small, running my own VW Golf, which I still own and which will run again in just a few months. And it was part of the IMSA Champion Spark Plug Challenge, and they had a pro stock division for the PP cars, I think Petey Cunningham used to call them, for little cars. My VW Golf was not even a GTI, but it was a good car in the pro stock class, which ended up being a lot like Volkswagen Cup, which was kind of winding down at the same time. A lot of people ran the VW Golfs in both series, including the Hacker brothers, Paul and Carl, Al Salerno, a couple other guys whose names you might remember. And so I came up to Road Atlanta in a car with 85 horsepower. So the first thing I noticed was that straightaway was really long. When you come out of turn 7, it's a long way to the bridge. And in the VW Golf, the dip, which was a really hairy, hairy corner in a fast car, like the prototypes at the time, it was just more of the straightaway in the Golf. And it made it a pure drafting game going down that back straight and trying to outbreak each other going into the bridge, turn 11. Which was more like a jump back in those days. It was one of the greatest corners ever because the car would get so light going over turn 11. Nowadays, they have actually cut down the hill somewhat, and it's an easy flat in almost anything except that it's really bumpy. And so if your car's really stiff or the shocks aren't set up right, it can be really hairy. So I showed up there in the Golf. I got pole, and I won the race because I did very well in pro stock that year. I won most of the races, although I didn't win the championship. I missed it by one point to, I think it was Paul Hacker, and that's another whole long story. But I was impressed with the high speed of the corners and how long that straightaway was. It lasted forever in an 85-horsepower VW Golf.
Great story.
Did you turn that? Did you roll that car down the hill from the 11 to 12 at one time?
No, I wasn't in Renault Cup.
Okay. Yeah.
Hi, Terry.
They did. Those would roll over like Easter eggs. They were something to watch.
They turned over in the back.
No, but Terry,
we turned over in my driveway.
Like yeah, I did something like that in another car, and if we get to like world record crashes at Road Atlanta, then I'll tell that story. Thanks.
Okay. Who wants to go next?
Yeah, Dave Wolin here. I got a little story about Road Atlanta. Bobby Archer might remember this also. The 81 or 82 or maybe 83 IRS race, it had rained, and then the rain kind of let up, and I was running about 10th and cresting the hill there. To just be turned two, I guess, was crest at the top of the hill and head downhill, and there's a river of red mud running across the road, and everybody was gone except me, and suddenly I was in third place. Then they all got caught up, and I ended up back in 10th. But that was you remember that, Bobby? You were there in something?
Well, that 81 was actually Tommy's and my IMSA debut, and we never made it to corner one at the start. It was a huge crash with Tommy and I and Irv Hare. Tommy actually ended up to the right side of the track in the ditch with a new Pope guitar. And that was not very good. But in 82, I actually had the pole in the rain. But I had a huge lead. And going up into corner two, there was a big crash right around the corner. And all the flag people were watching the crash versus me. And that brought the race to end for me. But so it was kind of a bad start because in 1980 I had won the national championship, you know, in SCCA. But you know, we went on to have a lot of good times there. A lot of good memories.
The range stuff, yeah, this is Terrier Wood. We were running Firehawk. It might have been called Motorola Cup by that time. But we had Jimmy Davis was spotting at the bridge for us because of pace cars and whatever. So anyway, it started raining on the back straightaway, and all of a sudden Jimmy yelled, I had just gotten in the lead over one of the Nonamaker cars. Gary Blackman behind me in a team car. Anyway, Jimmy yelled, there's a car in the woods in turn 10, car in the woods. So we slowed down a little bit going over the crest there at 10, and a little river was running across. This is before they put the state prison-looking guardrails up. This is just dirt. And anyway, there was a car hanging in the oak trees over there on the right. So we slowed down some and slid across the river. And on the way to the bridge, Gary yelled, look in the mirror, look in the mirror. And the entire field crashed behind us because they didn't have Jimmy spotting for them at the bridge. So we limped back around, and it looked like a junkyard. I mean, literally, there were 60 cars piled up.
Everybody.
Yeah. So they parked us on the front straightaway, and they were flagged it for a couple of hours. Boy, I had to pee like a big dog, and I finally did. But anyway, I was hungry. We wound up. Now, Randy, you said you wound up winning that race, but I think we won it. But that's okay. John.
Oh, no, you won your class, but I won my class.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Guess what?
Yeah. So John Green and I wound up winning that. But so we bought Jimmy Davis a steak dinner that night. Well, McDonald's, because he stayed free race.
Hey, Terry, I can go you one better on that same moment. I was in that race in a Honda Prelude, and there had been a pit stop, like a full course yellow. Bunch of us pitted. We already had the reins on. I convinced team owner T.C. Klein to put the reins on in the dry, sunny weather because that front was coming. And
wow. We
were one of the few cars, along with you, that did not go flying off into the woods. You're right. It was like 60 cars. It was really shocking.
Horrible.
It was kind of scary.
Yeah,
like,
really scary.
We were afraid. Yeah, we were afraid people might have been killed. I don't think they were, but cars were.
Well, nobody knew for the longest.
Yeah, I know.
It took that long to get everybody out of there.
Yeah, Dick Street got a broken leg out of it, and but I think that was the worst. It wasn't. It just tore a lot of cars up.
That's really lucky.
You guys remember what year was that?
84, 86.
No, 93.
93 or 94.
It had to be at least 88, 89.
No, it was 93 or something.
86 was the big crash.
I think it was like
84 was the big crash.
It was 96 when we were running the Nissans during that.
Yeah.
And we had two Nissans. Mark Mitchell was driving with me. And we had a cracked exhaust. We were running pretty well, but we had a broken exhaust. And the other car got mixed up in that big crash, and they ended up towing it in and red flagging the race. But we started pulling the exhaust off the totaled out car. And I remember one of the officials came up and said, oh, no, you can't walk on the car. It's a red flag. Or what are you going to do? He said, well, we'll disqualify you. I said, well, look at this car. This car's not going anywhere. He said, oh, okay. So we pulled the exhaust off and sat it next to the other car. And as soon as the yellow flag went on, we changed the exhaust. But they crashed a lot of cars.
Yeah, 84 was the big crash in turn 6 at runoffs when it was running only in turn 6. And that's the one that they awarded Jim Fitzgerald that win because he was the last one to cross the starting line of the lap before under green. Daddy was chief steward that year.
Wow. And this is Janet. And the race that you were talking about, that's the one that we pulled a car out that the license plate, when it was up on the tow vehicle, said racing to God knows where. Yeah. Down in the gully.
Yeah. In that
all right,
84
somebody
crash.
Else.
Good.
Uh-huh.
No.
Go ahead.
This is David Murray. How many of you remember the all-girl turn?
Turn 7?
Oh, yeah.
Turn 7. There you go. Yeah, the runoffs would come around there, and they'd have all women working turn 7 for the corner, all the corner workers. And every pace lap, you'd go by there, and they'd have their tops up, and their tops were hanging out, and they almost had everybody crashed on the pace lap. And then the enforcer forgot about that when you took the green flag. So
I had never heard that story.
It's one of those things yeah, some of those things are the memories of Road Atlanta that you think about the history of the place, where it came from, where it went to, and some of those iconic places that are there. And then, of course, if you remember Hazel, she was steward there for a while and corner worker forever and ever. And she actually, I spoke to her about that, was one of those topless women that turned 7 and unfortunately lost her life and working there for a motorcycle race, was hit by a motorcycle. But and she still has a memory, a memorial there. But some special times in Road Atlanta, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a fond memory.
Yeah, that morning, Daddy went
my husband still.
Yeah.
My husband still has. Well, we're okay.
Yeah, good, Jen.
My husband still has the beer, what he calls the beer titty from turn 7.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Thanks, special.
Oh, my.
Where was I? I was somewhere else.
And what is that, Janet? Forgot.
Well, you crossed. What?
What is a beer titty, Janet? Don't leave us hanging.
What? That's one of my husband's terms. Ask him.
He's not here.
Who no, he's listening,
question?
Though. He's not going to chime in. He's always called them that, and I think it started.
Hey, Greg.
I think it started at turn 7.
Got a question here from the audience for a couple of years. Ran in the Escort Series. Don Norris, Bobby Archer, maybe Randy. In 1986 or 87 was a terrible hot weekend. Temperature was 95, humidity 100%. And we had a 6-hour race there. Do you remember that, Norris?
I don't know if I was driving the view. I think maybe I drove the year after that. But I did hear about
it. That might have been 86. How about Bobby, do you remember that?
Oh, very, very cool. Yeah, we were running the Baker Corvettes, and Tommy and I won. I remember the Porsche Turbos packing their intercoolers with dry ice before the race, and the cars on the grid looked like they were on fire. But, yeah, that was hot that day. Morris? No, not Tommy Morris. Sponsored at race.
Yeah, Tommy Morrison. Yeah, yeah.
Morrison, yeah. He sponsored the race.
Morrison, yeah.
And we ruined his party. We won the race.
Oh.
Got another question for Rick Noop. Are you there, Rick Noop?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi, everybody.
Rick Noop. Tell us about driving something fast. Yeah. Tell us about driving something fast at Road Atlanta. You got a lap in a 962 or something like that you can talk about?
Yeah, sure. I was just going to kind of start this saying that being a second-generation road racer from the West Coast, specifically Northern California, that if you made the trek there, whether it was for the runoffs or you were running for points with RJ Reynolds and the Camel and all that, I always thought that was a pretty special acknowledgement that maybe you're doing something right. And if you want to, I've driven different categories there, from Team Highball when I was in the World Endurance Championship to Jim Busby and Porsche's 962s. I can tell you this. I've driven Can-Am cars for a long time, McLarens and stuff like that. So I always had a lot of respect for that place, and to finally get there either for the points or whatever. And I'll give you some recollections of driving a 962 there. We always seem to do all right there. The sheer speed prior to the chicane was something that was pretty awe-inspiring. As the car would get up to the 190 range or whatever, it would take a pretty good set at the barrel. I'm going to call it the barrel. You know, the car would get pretty loaded going up towards the bridge. And to say, are we pulling G's? I don't know. But those are the days when a GTP car, if it was set up properly, they were pretty sensitive to rake back then because we didn't have splitters. So you had a pretty interesting dynamic for the spectator, it looked like maybe you were going into the pits. But inside, you wanted to maximize the speed, the downforce, plus your sponsors had some idea of, like, a front row seat, how you would negotiate that turn. So I'm not really a showboat guy, but if you wanted to get hired and you had somebody there, and all of us that are on this call right now have had factory involvement, it was good for you to not only be crisp through there, but it took a little bit with that sort of power to weight or index of performance. And the topography there was always fascinating. My track that I'm kind of a Laguna Seca, old Laguna in Can-Am cars, and then also Sears Point. So, but it, for me, before sand traps and everything, I loved the challenge, big horsepower, accuracy, respect for the car and the team, and traffic management. But you didn't want to load back into the trailer with any red clay on it, and it would stay on for 6 months afterwards. It was kind of like a tattoo you didn't want. So my recollection is I really loved it. There was an awful lot of hospitality there. The old Atlanta or the underground was a blast. And we just got down to business there. And if the car was right, and you guys know this, you could really go there. And those are just some of my thoughts. And like I said, I've driven quite a few different categories there, but the 9662s, it took a while to feel comfortable, even though you were going fast. You just didn't come off the trailer and say, oh, this place is nothing. Yeah, you wanted to work into it, or else, you know, you might need a dolly to bring the parts back.
Just on a note with that, this is David Murray again. I was teaching one of the Road Atlanta driving schools with Doc Bundy. And up until that point, I'd only driven like Formula Fords and stuff like that and some showroom stock stuff. And we were walking the track, and we came down there. This was pre-turn 10, same thing when we had the dip. And I remember Doc taking the group out there and talking to him and said, when you get to the dip and you come out, just let the car drift all the way to the right. You got time to get back to the left before you make the right turn for the bridge. And I didn't say anything, but I thought to myself, why is he saying that? Why wouldn't you stay to the left? Because in the Formula Ford, it was no issue whatsoever, 120 miles an hour and all the grip in the world, stay to the left. Until I drove a fast car and then a prototype and then realized what he was talking about was, oh, now I get it. So lots of respect for the Can-Am days. And when the 962 is one thing, the Can-Am's probably even worse than that with the cars being so fast with less grip. So it was definitely eye-opener.
We got a visitor here who won in 1987 in showroom stock B in a Peugeot. And I'll unmute him and see if he can just say, Victor Van Tress.
Thank you. I thought I was just going to lurk in the background. My voice is kind of messed up, so I don't know if you can hear me. But I was going to mention something I got a kick out of. Everybody's going to go, oh, yeah, Kudzu. That place was overrun with Kudzu. And when I went to my Miami a couple of years ago, I went down in this Key Biscayne area, and there was more Kudzu. I'm going, oh, man, you guys have no idea what's coming. This place is going to be taken over. The Whittingtons, I think, are the ones cleaned
out. Oh, that's
out,
funny.
It was amazing.
That was a Jim Downing gift.
Was it?
That was a Jim Downing gift, Kudzu was.
He didn't bring it with him, but he sure didn't make the best of it, didn't he?
I thought his granddaddy or somebody come bring that from another country somewhere, bring it over here?
That's the story I got.
I don't think his family necessarily, but it did come over from Japan. It was supposed to have been a an erosion detector.
Well, that's my story. I'm sticking to it.
Yeah. Okay, I'll ask him. I'll ask him when I talk to him Friday.
Him,
okay.
Yeah.
I will.
Put it into that.
there was one area that we pitted 81 and 82, and it was the driver's left of turn one and down the hill, and that's where he pitted. Well, the Kudzu went up a telephone pole across a guide wire and down. And if you looked at it, it looked like Godzilla. So we called it Godzilla. That's where we fit it.
Red Mud and Kudzu. That was Road Atlanta back then.
It was. It was amazing stuff. The fact that they ripped it all out. I forget when it disappeared, like 85 or 86, something up there. And here we come the next year, and it's like, wow, this is different.
It's real hard to get rid of, I can promise you.
Well,
kind of fond of it myself.
That's what I mean. I went to Miami, and I saw some there. And I went, you people have no idea what's going to happen down here. The place is going to get run over. Oh, well. Thank you for letting me.
Another place to hide their lizards. I'm glad you joined us. That's very nice. I appreciate it.
Took a little doing because the code to get in was different between what was in the ad and what was on the website. It was a different number.
Oh, really?
The first one didn't let me. Yeah. First one I called was 66216. And the last one was 62616.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you made it. That's the whole point.
But I did. I figured I'd be a lurker in the background, but thank you for letting me.
Enjoy. Guys. Enjoy.
Thank you, Beth.
We always have a good time.
Come back later. Okay.
So how did we feel about the dip? Did you love it or hate it?
The dip.
And how did you feel when it was restructured?
Well, I
missed the dip.
Yeah. As drivers, we all miss the dip. As an instructor, I don't, because, you know, we have vested interest in the cars. All honesty, of all the chicanes in the world, that usually they're just stupid, like the festival turns at Portland, which is the world's worst. But it actually works. It gives you another passing zone. And on the last lap, it gives you a passing zone. If the guy stays with you, then you can go side by side all the way over the top of the hill. So it actually it increases the excitement, as far as I'm concerned, as far as the spectators are concerned, and the safety with the racers. I personally missed the dip, and in trying to, when Doc said it's going to go to the right and come back over there, and just pucker up and you try to get back to the left and apex off the bridge like Randy was talking about it. And with two wheels in the air, it just and the track was. People don't realize how much narrower the track was back then.
This is right.
Yeah, it's a good 8 to 10 feet wider in mostly everywhere, but especially coming out from under the bridge. The reason that pit in was so stupid back then was when Walker and the guys bought the property. The chicken farmer that lived next door was the last one to sell out. So literally to start paving, they had to tighten up the pit lane. That what is now your entrance to head to the bridge? Well, that was a chicken farm. So everything was over further toward what is now the Michelin Tower. And that also made a real hard, tough pit in. I think Noop said, you had to sort of use the track out of the bridge and pit in to get a good run through turn 12. And just try to miss the rumble strips, but it was much tougher to drive when it was much narrower. It was a lot more fun as far as I'm concerned. I still love it. Don't get me wrong, but it was tougher back then.
Well, I saw people getting hung up on those rumble strips, and they would get not trying to pit. They were just trying to get the heck out of Dodge over to the front straight, and it was that got real hairy right there. Anybody else got a dip story?
I was. Trying to pass Pepe Pombo for the win in a regional race. And we came out from under the bridge and I went wide and he sort of tucked inside me. And I go, that's okay. That's going to be fine. I'm going to be, I have the bigger radius here. But as I went to go back to the track, he stayed wide and literally stayed wide and he still stayed wide. So I had to lock it up and come into pits. And Mama, who didn't want me road racing anyway, she was up in the tower with my brother, and she said, well, praise the Lord, he's coming in. And Steve said, I don't think it's on purpose.
Look out below.
Yeah, it wasn't on purpose. I
can see how that would happen, yes. Uh-huh.
I've got a Pepe Pombo story. I remember I ran the runoffs for Dave with the Mitsubishis in 1988, and there was Mitsubishi Starion, and Pepe was running the Nissans, I think General Tire sponsored Nissans. And I remember thinking, well, Pepe's the hot guy. He's the guy who knows the track. He's local. He's fast. I'll follow him around during one of the practice sessions. And he goes in and tries to stay with him, which is a challenge in itself. And he gets to turn seven. And just before he turns into seven, he drops the left rear wheel off in the dirt and then goes into turn seven. Oh, he made a mistake. And so, okay, next lap around, he does it again. And then I finally realize it's not a mistake. This is his trick to point the car into the apex. And one of the reasons why he's so fast there. And then we ran the race in 1988. I qualified eighth place in Sharon Stock A with a Starion, probably like 30 cars in the field. And I moved up and made one place up. I finished up seventh place and Pepe won. And I remember when they interviewed him on the podium, he goes, yeah, I still have to make it through tech. And, of course, he didn't. And second place didn't. And third place didn't. So my line is that I started in eighth place. I finished in fourth place. I passed more cars in the tech shed than I did on the racetrack.
Yeah, mainly because Ben Burrell was building those Datsuns back then. Yeah, and Buddy Ben Burrell had some good tricks for the Datsun.
Wow. Funny.
Yeah, I got a dip story. Can Randy go again on a dip story? I was racing a Mazda RX-7 Turbo in 1994 with T.C. Klein again. The car was really new. And I sat down in the car on practice day and banged my head on a bare roll cage. And I called T.C. on the radio. I said, T.C., we got to pad this roll cage. He goes, yeah, okay. Well, they were busy with the car, didn't want to run. It was brand new, Mazda RX-7 Turbo. In, oh, God, what was it then, you guys? Motorola Cup? Or I don't think it was Firehawk anymore. Maybe. Nice car. And in the next practice session, I'm out running around. And this was the last year of the dip. So I guess it was 94 or 95. Right, Janet or Trish, you would know. I come down through
the dip. Well, after Dr. Painos took it out. So that was... He got there in 96, so it would have been sometime right around then.
He was 1 year too late for me because I go down into the dip at 153 miles an hour in this RX-7. Coming up to the bridge, I go to the brake pedal, and I got a firm pedal but no brakes. And all you guys know what I'm talking about. Those early ABS systems could easily get confused, and they can. Yeah, ice pedal. But it was worse back then. And I hadn't experienced it before. And I come up that hill and I'm pushing. I'm like, what? How can I have a good brake pedal, in fact, way too good, really firm, and not be stopping? And meanwhile, here comes the bridge at 150 miles an hour. And I threw the car sideways best I could, but that made it turn a little bit in. And it caught the dirt on the inside edge of the bridge, moving. If you've ever driven straight into the wall in a video game at full speed, that's what it looked like, except this was real. And the car caught that dirt, and it went upside down. And it came out from under the bridge, upside down in the air, spotless, not a scratch on it, but it wasn't going to be that way for long. And I remember, you know how people talk about in a crash, time slows down? Well, it did for me. And the thought ran through my head, I could end up in the hospital on this one. And I hit that dirt bank. And, Terry, that's when I came rolling down the hill in the RX-7. And everybody on pit lane could see it. And to shorten the story, I did end up in the hospital. I got a real live concussion from that unpadded roll cage. It's the only real injury I ever got in a race car, knock wood, yet. And when I got back from the hospital, I'm a little fuzzy, walking in the paddock. Here comes T.C. Klein, the car owner. First thing he says to me is, it's got a pedal. he'd gotten in the car and, you know, checked the brakes. And I looked at him and I said, well, it didn't effing stop.
Yeah, we actually.
We know it's got a pedal.
Yeah.
Oh, God, that's awful.
We did not run ABS when it first came out because of that. The icing.
You're smart.
The Eagle Talons, we literally disconnected it. I never got to run ABS.
You were smart, Terry.
Top of that.
So, punchline is, 1 year later, they put in the chicane, turn 10A, turn B. I'd had the same incident a year later, the car would have been completely undamaged. There's a beautiful, long, uphill gravel trap that stops cars every time before they hit anything. We'd have been fine, but I was a year too soon, and that is the reason why they put that in there, because if you had a problem going up to that bridge, there was nowhere to go. You went straight into the wall.
Well, the bridge probably ended more careers than any other corner in America, as far as I'm concerned, and that's what we talk about, because, you know, there's so many people, the brakes, if they're going to fail, that's where they fail. Last lap of a dadgum 12-hour race, my teammate, my best friend, Jeremy Dale, took me out at the bridge. He tells a different story, but still, he got me in the left rear quarter panel, turned me straight into the dirt bank to the left. I could see the checkered flag from the bridge, and we were leading, and turned me straight left. I was so incredulous, I hadn't lifted until today. I hit that tire wall so hard, it barrel rolled down the hill, landed on its feet, though, and I was afraid I'd taken both of us out. I knew Rossi was going to kill me. So I said, Jeremy, are you okay? The radio was still working. He goes, yeah, I just won. He said, come on, we got a lap on the field. Come on down there. I go, well, you son of a bitch. So, but it wouldn't go forward. It was towed out worse than my first cousin on prom night. So but it would back up. So I literally back down pit lane, there's something about going backwards on pit lane, but anyway, so I backed down pit lane because all I had to do was cross the start finish line, you know, in the pit lane and to get second place. But I could look up at the tower and I saw Rafoff come in from the third floor, chewing his cigar off. I sort of passed the car under the yellow back in turn three on that lap too, and maybe turn 11. But there was a Camaro upside down at the bridge I went inside. That's another story. But fortunately, all the corner workers right there in the EV knew, you know, because I'd been working there for years. Daddy helped design the track, and so they knew it was me, and they surrounded the car. So when Rafoff couldn't get to me, and he saw it was going to be an unpopular decision anyway, so they carried me over. I said, "Would y'all walk me to the winner's circle over there?" I said, "Because I need the help," and we did. And fortunately, he never brought it back up, and I'm hoping he's not listening. Anyway, so we were checking. Now, Jeremy tells a different version, but he took me out. He took my ass out. Canadians, you got to discount 15%.
Had to have been there.
Yeah.
Anybody else with a dip story?
Here's another question for Bobby Archer and John Norris. Anyway, you guys
okay.
In the truck series there got something to say about truck racing in Atlanta?
Oh yeah, it was great. You know, especially the back straightaway. I think the last time we finished second and third behind maybe Jeff Krasnoff and the Nissan. Mark Gurman was one of the sponsors. He owned Rugged Liner, and I think both times we went there, he rolled one of our trucks over. But yeah, that was fun. It was interesting because we drove the Corvettes in the Escort Endurance Series and then the trucks the next day. So, you know, the dynamics of the two vehicles were pretty wild.
Yeah,
I never saw truck races.
You still there, Norris?
Yeah, sorry, couldn't hear you there. I don't think I ran the trucks for you there. I ran the trucks 1 year, but I don't think that was once again. I don't think that was my time. Well, if they do, I don't remember it.
Well, maybe not. It's all turned into a blur.
Yeah. But we ran. We did so much racing there between the Mitsubishi, between the Eclipse and the Starion, and then the trucks and everything, and the endurance racing and the international sedan and stuff like that.
I remember racing a bit when we ran International Sedan. Remember when we had with the Eclipse, we had trouble with the brakes, so we put the bigger brakes on, which meant you had to put offset the wheels more, and you got the spacers made. So the outside of the wheels stuck out further than the whole car. And I remember the first lap of one of the races coming up in the International Sedan, coming up alongside Parker in one of the Acuras and getting into rubbing each other. And the wheel from the Eclipse just hacked up the whole side of his car like a Boadicea sword. I remember that.
Yeah, in International Sedan, actually, Janet Lupcher, two husband to your son, ran an International Sedan. One of them, didn't they?
My son. Yeah, Grayson raced for quite a long time in various classes. It was my son, and he's still racing a little bit, and now we have a grandson who's racing go-karts.
Congratulations, yeah. In 1989, we barely got the Eclipse done and took him down to the track in Atlanta and finished him there in the garage. Got there early that week, and it rained all week. And you guys arrived.
I remember.
It worked very well, but we were there, yeah.
I remember that, and I remember we had an issue because we had different motor mounts. Try to firm up the motor mounts. Steve Ruiz had designed some harder motor mounts, and it changed the harmonics of everything in the car, and it broke. It cracked oil pans. It broke the wastegate bracket. It broke the power steering bracket, and the vibration started breaking stuff. And what was funny was, maybe funny to me, it would break the same thing on each car at different times. So I'd break an oil pan one practice session, and then Mike would break it the next practice session, and then he'd break a power steering pump. I remember breaking the power steering pump bracket as we turned into turn five and lost the power steering. And that's back when they used to have that big dirt wall on the outside of turn five. And it's one of those things where at the last second you sort of conjure up the extra strength to crank the wheel, because you know if you don't, it's going to be a big crash.
Yeah, well, fortunately, the statute of limitations has expired, but those cars were still illegal. They weren't illegal enough.
It's just everybody else was better illegal.
Actually, if I can jump in here, may I say something about turn
sure.
five? Turn
Who's
five
this?
Is another – this is Randy Pope. Sorry, Chris.
Okay.
Turn five is another interesting Road Atlanta-only feature. The track has the configuration to be able to run two shorter circuits. At turn five, you could cut through the infield and take a shortcut into the back straightaway. And then there was
right.
another one taking a shortcut from the back straightaway to turn five. I don't think I've ever seen that used, certainly not in the modern era. They put walls and fences up. But what it meant was on the exit of turn five, there was a track, an on-ramp, coming from the right-hand side that joined the track on the right.
Mm-hmm.
Turn five was
mm-hmm.
a really steep uphill left-hander, kind of medium speed, tricky for a lot of reasons. One, it's much steeper than it looks. You should go out there and try to ride a bicycle up that hill. That's where I learned my lesson about 25 years ago. It's almost impossible, even in first gear. It is. It's very steep, and that's why almost every car you ever drive is going to feel like it's not running right when you come out of turn five, because it's so steep it makes the car feel really slow. The other thing is, due to the on-ramp coming in from the right side, there's the option of going across the exit curbing into that extra pavement, and that's changed a bit over the years. They added a curb. They kind of painted it. The ground is moved. There have been different levels of sending it
mm-hmm.
in turn five. You can go all four wheels all the way, but if you do, over the years, typically it's been very rough, and you're taking your chances. It's also dirty. The paint changed over the years. You never knew really how much of that paint you could use, or God forbid if it was wet. So turn five was, it was really interesting corner. Also, because about halfway out towards the exit, the road became crowned like a street, so that water would run off of it.
There was no drainage to speak of. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I went straight down, but up down into the middle of the S's. But that's another story. But one unique factory in Road Atlanta is turn five and that exit curbing. How much, if any, are you going to use, especially for a long race? Because it was bumpy. It was hard on everything under the car.
Randy, this is Terry. The turn five, of course, you know, originally, I don't know if you saw it was dirt banks originally at the exit. Anyway, for some reason, my father, and most of you guys know him, Daddy, Charlie Earwood, because he was chief steward for all of us driving. He black flagged me twice when I'm about over. But turn five was going to be 3 feet taller. So the next time you go out there, look at the hill that comes, the spectator hill that comes across the track, and then look to your left. And you'll see, oh, this has been actually cut down from the original terrain. For some reason, whatever year they were building the track, Daddy was on track approval or disapproval with SCCA. And he got to turn five and goes, guys, I got cars that will never climb this hill. And they said, yeah, but this is a Georgia granite under here. We've already dynamited, you know, thousands of dollars dynamiting it down to where it's at now. And Daddy goes, I'm sorry, you got to take 3 more feet out of it. So they spent a lot more. So turn five would have been a lot worse than it is now if Daddy hadn't blown it up.
Wow.
Well, this
I've,
is
got a, I've got a turn five story too. I was out there. Nobody, I wasn't supposed to be out there in a 68 Buick Riviera coupe. And and it cornered like a yacht, you know, just about what you expect. But I was out there having fun. And I ran out of gas on five. And, of course, there are no cell phones. I didn't have a radio, and I just sort of had to sit out there until somebody noticed that I hadn't shown up in a while. They came out and got me.
What were you doing out there, Trish?
Yeah. I was having a good time.
She's in the back seat.
And another time I wasn't in the back seat. I was by myself. I thought I was going to have to walk back. We were testing the JLP 4 or 3. I don't remember now. Anyway, and the whole crowd was there, the team. And the bottom fell out, and it rained like no tomorrow. And everybody except crew members just got up and left, and they left. And we were there with pack everything up in the wet trailer and with nothing else to do, all piled into the dually and went out there to play on the track. And it was pouring. And I was driving. I don't know why. And I did a 360 at the bottom of the S's in a pot, in a lake of water. Just slow motion 360. It was really kind of exciting. And it was. We all laughed and laughed.
Well, I think that's a good, this is Janet. I think that's a good segue into skiing Road Atlanta. Terry Lee, you want to tell that story?
Which one?
About skiing Road Atlanta.
Sting?
Skiing. Like skiing. When we skied the racetrack. I'll go ahead and tell it. It was snowing like crazy in Georgia.
Oh,
it was
skiing.
Snowing like crazy in Georgia. And
skiing. I'm sorry.
Go. Take it away.
I have put up with this for years. Anyway, so I called the track and said, I'm not coming out today because it's snowing. And Terry Lee said, oh, it's not snowing. Come on out. It's fine. So I get out there, and I had a turbo. I think it was a Nissan Turbo, and it spun all the way from Lawrenceville in the ice. But we get out there, and I called my husband and said, hey, how about bringing the skis out? So we did. So we skied Road Atlanta. I think we were the only people that ever did it. And Terry took out all the school cars. And how many did you wreck?
I didn't wreck any of them. I stuck all seven. It different places, and like Trish said, like having to walk back from five, walk back to seven, walk back from turn three. I everything out there stuck. You know, fortunately, Tomei Tommy had that 4x4 Dodge, which y'all skied behind, and he would come and pull me out. I didn't wreck nothing. I just spun out. a lot.
And that's his story, and he's sticking to it.
Yep, I hear that too.
Now wait a minute. I used to work with Terrier Wood at. I used to work at the Terrier with Terrier Wood at the Skip Barber Driving School, Terry. And didn't you used to say that a spin is just a crash where you were lucky not to hit something?
Yeah.
You know, words come back to haunt you sometimes.
Yeah, but in the same we were trying to spin. There's a difference.
Well, the other story that I would love to hear Terry tell that I've never heard you tell on the radio or anything else was when you taught the deposed king of Afghanistan. You remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
The anti-terrorism school.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Man. This is pre-Taliban.
Yeah. And they had they didn't speak a word in English, they claimed. And but they had this big.
How many people were there?
10 or 12.
Okay.
And they'd gone to Mitch Warbell's school up there in Marietta to learn how to rappel mountains and throw tomahawks and whatever you do. And then they sent them to us for 2 days to drive. So we had this one little guy that we wouldn't let drive at all because he wore his helmet backwards every day. And I said, until he turns his helmet, I'm not going to let him drive. But they assured me he couldn't drive anyway. A little bit short guy. So finally, on the end of the last day, they said, look, let the guy drive on the skid pad for a few minutes. And
slow down.
I got a lot to say. So I said, look, all right, I'll tell you what I did. We had Datsun 260Zs back then. I said, tell you what, the interpreter was too tall to lay in the back, but I wasn't. So I said, look, when I'm going to let him drive, and I'm going to holler to you what to do, but if he gets in trouble, you grab that handbrake, you know, we got to stop this car. So he said, I got it. So we go out, and he starts adding power, and he ain't come off the gas till today. And so finally he gets to doing 360s. And spinning, I'm yelling, handbrake, and they're all just sitting there screaming. But anyway, so finally, I'm laying in the back of this Datsun. I ain't got on a jockstrap. I'm just laying in the back of this Datsun trying to survive. But as you all know, that Road Atlanta skid pad, if you go over the back, you're going to be rolling for a while because it goes so far downhill down to the creek. So sure enough, we head backwards over that creek. Finally, the interpreter handed me the handbrake, and so we're pulling on it just as tough as we can. Finally, it stalled the motor. So just as we're going over the bank, it sort of teetered there, and I go, hey, we live. And they learned a couple of words of English. I had to teach them second gear. I wanted second gear and everything. So whatever that word is, and then one of the things they learned from me after they did everything. Either good or no good. That was the only two words. So he looks around at me.
A handbrake.
I'm never forget to look at this little bitty short guy. He looks around at me and goes, no good? No good. But don't get out because this damn thing's going down the bank. So I said, open, pull the hatch sling and let me out here. So I go up to the classroom and leave them down there without money, but I had to do a suit change. I go to leave without money, and I come down there, and they're all standing around this car in the middle of the skid pad. I go, what the heck? I go down there, and this 280Z Datsun is sitting on top of a 55-gallon oil drum, but it's sitting straight up and down, trash drum. I go, how in the hell did you get that car on top of that 55-gallon barrel? You know, I was riding in it, but I can't explain it. We went past the guys, but it was those were tough, man. You know, this teaching was easy. Well, it was. Especially we don't speak English. Those look bad. It was Gabon.
Oh my gosh!
And
what did the king?
And by the way,
the king.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the king. You know, we came down the hill doing a brake exercise. You know, at 50 miles an hour. Well, they were looking at the tack, and at 5,000, that's a lot more than 50 miles an hour. And they were sailing out the front gate. It was a pretty painful 2 or 3 days. But I about got over. Thanks for bringing it up.
That is a wonderful
And Trish,
story.
The kicker to that is that same day I was entertaining all of the people from all the welcome centers in the state of Georgia. And Terry Lee forgot to tell me that the deposed king of Afghanistan had a group of thugs with him, all who had submachine guns, and they were all hiding out in the woods. So I'm taking all these Welcome Center people around the track and showing and telling them what a nice place we have, and he's doing his shenanigans down on the skid pad, and meanwhile, back at the ranch, there are machine guns pointed at all of us. So that was the rest of that story.
Oh, you should see the
Yeah. Good God.
Some news helicopter came over the top of the hill, and you talk about 12 little guys running. I ain't never seen them scattered that quick. It's hard to get them all back together. But, hey, we're not being attacked. It's just a news channel, WSB or somebody. But it was
news helicopters chasing the Afghani. Oh my gosh!
They ran hard.
Yeah. I would too, I think.
And we used to mail them there.
So those poor people.
You know, we mail the diplomas to them. You know, they give me your address, your name, and we'll mail the diplomas to you. When Whittington gets back in town, he'll sign them. And all the diplomas came back. There was, you know, no address. And I go, well, we won't do this anymore. So we have no idea who they really were.
For heaven's sake.
So what are y'all's fondest memories of that racetrack as far as just the – just being there.
Definitely wasn't the food.
Was it making it to the runoff?
Winning.
Winning.
I can't.
Yeah. Everybody on this phone call, I guess winning is one of the biggest things.
This Randy,
so we like
I got
anyway.
One.
We don't care where
we ask Rick Noop. We got a question here from the audience. I think he's the guy anyway. Rick. Did you drive there at GTU or GTO?
Yes. I drove with the Kent Racing. I was sort of there anytime they had a longer race. Dave Kent and Bob Bergstrom, Brad Frizzell. It was an interesting group out of the Southern California area. And, yes, I did. I drove... in GTU, and then also in 82, the Toyota factory, prior to All American Racers and Dan Gurney, Kent Racing, we debuted number 92 and number 98. 98 was driven by Lee Mueller, and I drove the fastback version, and both powered by 2-liter twin overhead cam. Beautiful little motors. We had a great engine builder, and we had some teething problems for a while because they were newer cars. But yes, to answer your question, GTU and that GTO with Howard Meister in an RSR. So I've driven, I guess, quite a few different categories there, and I've had reasonable success.
Another question here, probably for Sir David Murray. Describe a lap around the track in some kind of fast car.
Repeat that question, please, is David.
Yeah. Describe a lap around the track.
From when it started back in the 80s, my first time there was I used to watch the runoffs and the IMSA races there back in the mid-70s. I missed the beginning of the track, but mid-70s, 75 or so. And then my first time on the track was 81. And so that was, of course, back in the original configuration, the skinny track with the dip and where the bridge was actually a turn, not going down the hill and stuff. And they had the pit lane was separated by that curbing. So to me, it's turn one, and depending on the type of car it is, the GT car is actually more challenging than a prototype. In a prototype, the right-hander down the S's and turn 12 are easily flat. And so I was always disappointed in it took away some of the driving ability of the track when you're in one of those cars. as opposed to a GT car. And then even the GT cars, when we did the LMS, the GTLM cars, they got so good with downforce that you could go flat in 12 and just about flat in the S's, not quite. And so turn one, high speed. And, you know, it's funny. They had a difference when in the old days when the track was really smooth and nice, there was you could just float the car into turn one and get it to actually start turning before you went in the corner. And then as it got a little bit of a dip there at the turn end, you couldn't quite do that anymore. But turn one is high speed, obviously fourth gear, the momentum up the hill. Depending again,
funky camber, isn't it?
What's that?
Isn't it kind of a funky camber?
It's an off camber thing. Something that really that stood out in my mind was when you run different cars, different lines up turn one, and it really set me off when I watched the motorcycle race there. And those motorcycles going up on the right side of the track instead of the left side because they got so much, and that's when the revelation of power versus or acceleration versus cornering. So they've got tons of acceleration, no cornering, so they just want to get the bike straight so they can go up the hill. Whereas you get a spec race, so you go all the way out almost to the very edge of the curve. And so, yeah, it's just a high-speed turn. You can't go too far out to get back to the left. And then turn three was always my favorite. It's funny, when I watched the races before I drove the track in the 70s, the only turn I couldn't see was turn three because it had so many trees or you couldn't get there as a spectator. So the first time I drove it, it was like, wow. And that became my favorite turn of the whole track. It was just a kink, basically, instead of a turn, and you could use up so much of the curb. But it was one of my favorite turns. And then, of course, the rest of it's like downhill skiing through the S's. And then, like Randy said, turn five is so steep, doesn't matter how much power you've got, you have to get momentum to come up the hill and get back on the power soon. And then if you're using that curb on the exit, it bounces. And so if your shocks are just right, then you can stay flat and make ground going over the curb. But if the shocks aren't good, even though the car is just bouncing up and down a little bit, you're losing forward momentum, forward traction, so you can't use the curb. So depending on the car, and of course, then you get the really show them stock, the Mazda and things like that, you can run all the way, all four wheels over the curb into to the access road where the cut through is and use all that momentum to get going. Turn six is so much banking that you carry the brakes all the way to the apex, so you get all that G loads. And funny, as we went through a lot of driver schools, that was the corner that you couldn't get people to go to the limit because it had the banking had so much more G loads on your body than any other corner. They couldn't get to that point. But that's an awesome turn. Just the banking gets steeper as you get to the apex and flattens back out. Very similar to an oval. And then, of course, turn seven is a hairpin. Then down the back straight, that's the easy part unless you don't have power. And then getting the car straight before you brake, right, is super critical. Even if I always thought about having the wheel straight by a half second before you went to the brakes, because even if it was straight, there might be a little weight on one side or the other. And that's what crashes a lot of cars in the brake zone of 10 today. The car's not quite straight, or it might be a little bit of weight on one side of the car. It hadn't straightened up yet. And then that weight, when you have the brake pedal, turns the car sideways and makes it wag, and depending how stable or unstable the car is, a lot of times cause the accident hitting the guardrails before you get to turn 10. And, of course, now with the big gravel trap there, that's a big turn, but now you got the gravel trap to take up some of the slack if you make a mistake. And, of course, if it's wet, the left side of the track has like an ice patch, so if you try to outbrake someone, very difficult in the wet because that side's a lot less grip. And, of course, then coming up the hill, you run over the curbs in 10A and B, but the exit curb, you got to be careful not to go too far. You go a little too far, it sucks you out. And I think, Boris said, I think it was, got a test in the Panos GT car there and ended up crashing and knocked himself out in the bridge abutment because once you drop that wheel off the left too far, it loses so much grip, it'll hook you back to the inside. Of course, now with the bridge abutment, it's a pretty big hit. And then, of course, under the bridge now is not even a turn, it's just flat, but first time there, it's always funny to watch people there because that's the biggest corner they've got when they first arrive at the track because it's so blind. But once you know where you're going, it's not really a turn at all. And then coming down to 12, that's one that's really unique. You need to try to keep the weight loaded to the left side of the car slightly to get that turn in for 12, so you don't have that big transition, and it makes the corner a lot easier. The one experience I had there was we tested, I'll show my age now, Winston Cup car. They're getting ready for Watkins Glen. And with we were about the same lap time with sticker tires as a GT 993 RSR GT3 GT car. But for the first lap after that, the tires went off in the stock car so bad, you could only go full throttle. This is the weird part because nobody ever thinks of this. From turn 11, the bridge, down to turn 12, that little straightaway on an angle, you could only go full throttle in the stock car like four laps with sticker tires before it would go off, and you couldn't go full throttle down that hill, which blew me away because in any other car on the planet, sports car, you never even think about that. It's just a little straightaway. So, of course, you got 800-900 horsepower with skinny hard tires for a big heavy car. So, but it's got to be one of my favorite tracks. I think Road Atlanta and Mossport Canadian Tire now have to be the two biggest tracks by far in North America and pretty much in the world as well, anywhere I've been to.
Neat. I like that rundown. I'm going to give Janet a time to talk about being a manager of that track. How did it feel to finally get a place like that? How did you get that job?
I think I bumbled into it. Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
I actually started working there part-time back in 79, and I found in a file later on that Bill Whittington had met me at Pine Isle Resort and said to hire me to do anything. And there was a lot of change in the track because of a Georgia jam. Terry can attest to this. And the management changed, and I saw an opportunity, and I loved the racetrack. I really love a challenge, and every day at that place, the people that I met, all you drivers that are on there right now, you just to make that show for you guys was what I wanted to do every day, and hopefully pull that off.
I have a question for Janet.
I'm sorry.
So I have a question for you. This is David. With all your tasks that you were doing,
okay.
were you ever tasked to burn ticket stubs? You don't have to answer that.
No, I was not. You know, I mean, that's something that everybody wants to know about Road Atlanta, and it goes on and on. But thankfully, none of that ever touched me, and we didn't get involved in it. You know, I just ran the track and did it to the best of my ability and let all that stuff go on somewhere else. But it never affected Road Atlanta, thank goodness. It was a dark period, I guess, in some respects, but we tried to keep the light on it.
Part of history.
And hopefully pulled it off.
Hey, this is Randy. I got a question on that same thing. Was the back straightaway ever used to land drug smuggling airplanes? I heard that rumor in the 80s.
A lot of people say that. Randy.
No. No.
No.
No. Terry.
Yeah. Well,
I think that's the most frequently asked question ever, and no, it was not. But a lot of people landed on the back straight. I've landed on the back straight. It was used as a runway by a lot of the different racers, and not by what you've heard. No, wasn't.
Yeah. And
what did they do with the plane when they landed? Where'd they park it?
I'm sorry? Most of the guys would just take it up. Actually, they rode into the pits and sometimes park where the helicopters are now.
Okay.
Yeah, it was pretty funny because Don Whittington would fly up there in one of his little planes, and it was funny looking up and seeing a little plane coming out from the bridge all of a sudden with no warning. But it could come.
Yeah, I've seen this plane.
They parked it in the paddock.
I've seen this one.
The scariest days there was when Bill Whittington, we were in the tower for an IMSA race, and he buzzed us in his Bearcat. I mean, literally, I thought he was going to hit the building. It was pretty spectacular once you realized he wasn't going to hit us, but it was those guys.
I was actually in the tower when he did that, and as he came by, he actually waved. It was scary, to say the least.
Well, he was very skillful. He wasn't going to hit the building. But, man, oh, man, I guess it was cool.
No, those guys did air races, and, you know, they he was not going to hit the building.
Yeah,
but Bobby Allison landed there. Yeah, I mean, Bobby Allison landed on the back straight. Bill Elliott did. It just went on and on. A lot of the guys that flew their own planes would land on the racetrack.
Love it. What else? What did you do as a manager? What was a normal day like? Ha ha.
Honey, there were no normal days. I mean, absolutely. I think that's what I love. What I love the most about it was that there was a challenge every single day. It was always busy, and there was just never anything that was ever repetitive, which is what I loved about it. When Jim Fitzgerald came and became our driver training instructor after Terry Lee left, you know, we had a lot of glitz and glamour, and I don't know. It was just every day was a different story and a different challenge, and that's what I loved the most about it. And I got to meet some fabulous people, a lot of whom are on here with us tonight.
Okay, now, if I heard you right, Janet, you're saying that after Terry Earwood left, then you had a lot of glitz and glamour. Is that right?
That's what I heard, too.
I'm gonna backpedal on that one. Terry brought a lot of interest. Yeah, Fitzy bought the Hollywood crowd, and Terry Lee bought the rednecks. It was just great.
That's a good Lord loved us.
I love Terry.
You know. Oh, fantastic. We're going to wrap up not too long from now. Anybody got something they've been sitting on they want to tell us that they haven't told us
yet?
Let
me ask Victor Van Trask a question here. Victor, are you still on?
Oh.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. So
if you can hear me.
You towed your Mustang to the runoffs with another Mustang or something. Tell us that story.
Well, no. In 81 and 82, we were running a Mustang V8 Cobra in Sherwood Stock A. It was the tow car for two other guys, though. Terry Rohr with a Sherwood Stock C Rabbit and Bob Brewer with a Sherwood Stock A 280ZX. We towed it with the Mustang, then raced, then hooked it back up and towed it back. So it really puts a level on your head knowing that you can't make a mistake because you'll wreck the tow car. That ain't going to work out well. What I wanted to say
about
it got pretty good mileage. It was kind of funny. But what I wanted to say was 81 was the hardest rain I've ever experienced, let alone raced in. We were group one, and the rain dots that were hitting the windshield were about 3 inches in diameter. I mean, they were hitting like rocks. So I go back up to Goodyear, and I say, well, this is my first set of shake tires. I went, I got to give these up. Give me my old tires back. It's got more tread on it. And the guy says, no, you have a full set. So I got 4 brand new thick tires. I'm sitting on pre-grid. I've never turned a wheel in the rain. Go around on the base lap. Green flag dropped. Bang, hit the throttle. And my windshield turned white. You could see this little black stripe going back and forth. That was the backside of the windshield wiper blade. So I back off. I go, wow, I can't see. And then I go, but this is the race. And I hit the gas again. And then I lift again, and I go, but I can't see. And I look out the right, and I can see the right side of the track. And I go, okay, well, here comes turn one. And we went up the hill, and things began to settle down a little bit. What was interesting was when you run the air conditioning, if you have air conditioning, it runs a compressor. It's dehumidified. My windows were clear. I started 15th and finished 5th. I just kept going by people because they couldn't see. You'd see them sitting there. They have like a rag or something, and they're trying to make a little clear spot on their windshield. I didn't have any problem at all. So it was fun. We got the tow money from both the cars we towed, plus the tow money for the Mustang. So that was a big payday to us. At least then. Yeah.
Victor, you were towing two cars? Two car trailer? I don't understand. Hey, Victor, okay, you were towing two cars with the Mustang? Oh, well.
I think we've lost Victor. I think you did it twice, one car each time, flat towing it.
Well, you know, the Rabbit was on a single axle trailer, but the Z was flat towed. What was fun was I could run 12 volts from my car to their car, turn on their fuel pump, and pump gas into my car while we were driving. So we had like a 700-mile range.
Wow.
It was nuts. We got to Atlanta in 2.5 days from Los Angeles. And we weren't driving real fast because you get over 55 and everything starts wiggling around and it's pretty exciting. But yeah, we did that. We did. That's what the Mustang was good for. It was a good tow car.
Okay, Trish, button it up.
Oh, I guess we have to. Darn, this has been fun. I've enjoyed this one a lot. And now we've come to the end of another broadcasting day. I hope y'all enjoyed it as much as I did. I want to thank all our audience members and our panel of racers and track people for choosing to spend an evening with us. Our next show will be on Wednesday, September 21st, when we'll present a thriller, The Attack of the Trans Am Daredevils. You know them, you love them, now hear Trans Am drivers talking a bunch. So join us then, same time, same station. Good night.